Hello and welcome to the Dune Minute Podcast, your place to dive deep minute by minute into the cinematic adaptation of Frank Herbert's World of Dune. I'm one of your hosts, John.
And I'm Zach.
And we are back at it again. It's been a couple weeks, I think.
2 weeks. We took last week off.
Yeah, had to do some administrative stuff.
Which means I needed a day to edit.
Yep.
And to catch up on editing.
Yep. And I just needed to, you know, work on thumbnails and stuff. But we're back, and we are still in the midst of the whole Harkonnen attack on Arrakis and Arrakeen, and watching a shitload of Atreides just get their ass beat.
Yeah, it's not looking so good for them, honestly. No. It's they are kind of on the losing end of this fight, it seems.
Yeah, we left off the last episode we recorded with Duncan Idaho trying to save as many of the royal family as he could.
Or at least check in their bedrooms.
Yep. Turns out the number of people that he was able to save was zero.
Mm-hmm.
Because Paul and Jessica are nowhere to be found. And
they're already gone.
Leto is not doing so hot.
Nope.
So we start this minute off with just kind of looking at Paul's headboard where we left off. And then we very quickly find out where Paul is. He's unconscious in the back of an ornithopter.
Yeah, and I mean, I know the answer to this question, but I wrote down in my notes, like, is that still the sleeping pill that he took?
I would assume so, because, like, UA gives him the pill, so who's to say that UA didn't, like, triple his dosage to make sure that he was, like, super night-night, you know?
Yeah, that's fair, and that is confirmed in the books that it is that sleeping pill. But I was like, damn, dude, I need one of these things.
With the way that I sleep, I don't. But also, that'd be a good night's sleep.
Yeah. So I don't know. That's a heck of a sleeping pill.
Yeah.
As it turns out, yes, that it was. UA had, I guess, altered the dosage for these sleeping pills to specifically knock them out through the attack, and I mean to try to incapacitate them.
Mm-hmm.
As much as possible. And we know that clearly it didn't work for Leto because he didn't take his sleeping pill.
He didn't want the pill. He wanted to just have, you know, his forehead rubbed Jessica does the thing where she like rubs her thumb on his nose, and I guess that just like lulls him to sleep, which I mean,
so Leto is the same as any cat then.
Yeah.
So it's Paul's like, he's still KO'd in the back of this ornithopter. And then as he starts to wake up, we see that it's not just him there.
Yep.
There's a couple more people in there. Jessica is tied up beside him.
She's awake though.
Yes.
She's very, very present to what's happening.
Yep. And we get some, I think this is the first time we've heard the Harkonnen language.
It is. And it's mostly grunts and, you know, just kind of guttural noises. I went and looked on our friend David Peterson's website. There is nothing on his website about the Harkonnen language at all.
So maybe he didn't do this one.
Either he didn't do this one, or they just kind of figured from the beginning that they were always just going to have just kind of grunts and stuff and then go from there. The only thing on his website about this scene in particular is just a possible translation for battle language.
Oh, okay.
Which we'll get to later on because...
Sure.
We'll get to that right now
because
we see Jessica and Paul communicating through the Atreides battle language. Mm-hmm. Where she indicates that the Scarred, one of the three Harkonnen guards in this ship, one of them is the pilot, there's the Scarred one, and then there's just the other guard.
Yeah.
The Scarred one is a deaf man.
Yep. His name in the books, so we do learn his real name in the books. His name is Kinnett.
Kinnett.
Yep. Okay. K-I-N-E-T. Also referred to as Scarface. My first impression was, what an Uncle Fester looking motherfucker. So they're talking amongst themselves. basically giving us a synopsis of the conversation between the Baron and Gaius Helen Moheim in the Cone of Silence.
Peter DeVries.
Yeah. Yeah, just kind of redoing that or bringing the audience back up to speed pretty much.
I love that they're like working out the semantics in case they're brought before a truthsayer where they're just like, we can say we didn't kill them.
Yeah, which
is just left them in the desert.
Which is wishful thinking, honestly, as if they're not just going to be immediately killed when they get back.
Yeah, no, I feel like they 100% would. Like, what use does Vladimir Harkonnen have for these guys?
No,
none.
Not at
because
all.
Because he's got probably thousands of others that he can just easily replace them with.
Yeah, that's, I mean, the Death Guard was chosen because the voice, Jessica's voice, wouldn't work on him.
Yep.
And that's, I mean, that was why he was there, but there's really no need for him to have that knowledge afterwards. So yeah, that's something that is explicitly mentioned in the books that Jessica's like, why are they doing this? Or why are they like arguing over this? Don't they know they're just going to die as soon as they get back? Doesn't matter. So, that was, I don't know. It's very wishful thinking on the guard's part.
It's good to know though, that like the voice is an actual physical sensation. It's not just like I'm using this, but I'm also like telekinetically like communicating.
Yeah, I guess
either.
Like
it's truly auditory.
Yeah. Yeah.
So and we find that out later on as well because he's deaf.
So we get a shot to the outside after Jessica tells Paul that the scarred one is deaf. And I think this may be our first like lingering shot, at least, of a Harkonnen ornithopter.
It is. And it's very specifically in a Harkonnen ornithopter because unlike the super slim and sleek Atreides ship, this one is definitely more bulbous.
Yeah.
And more like armadillo shaped, almost looking like the drop ships that we saw last week that kind of like poof out.
Yeah.
As they're descending and everything.
They really like that design style, seems like. Because we got the ships and we cut immediately from this ornithopter lifting up to a like just massive, massive ship.
Yeah.
That before we get to what the ship does, I have to assume that this is the same kind of ship that we saw leaving Arrakis at the beginning. Because when the Harkonnens were leaving, we saw those like lima bean shaped ships like lifting off. I have to imagine these are something similar to that.
Similar. So I have a little bit of background on this, but let's go into what this ship does first, because
ship fucks shit up. That's what this ship does.
Yeah, we see from one ship just this massive artillery blast and just like completely decimates part of the city.
Do you know what it reminded me of? Maybe you have this in your notes too. I don't know, but
what?
It looks like the angel wing flares from a C-130 Hercules.
Yeah,
I'm not like a military plane guy, but I know enough to be like, as soon as I saw that, I was like, oh shit, that's exactly what that looks like.
Yeah, what do they call it? Like the angel of death,
something like that. Like that. I don't know, but
it looks fucking cool.
If you
the anti-missile system that they have in place,
if you get on your search engine of choice and just look up C-130 Hercules flare pattern. You'll see exactly what we're talking about. And it's like, it is pretty remarkably close.
Yeah. So about the ship. Yeah. So I just want to shout out first and foremost, we talked about it a little bit. I think it was the episode when we were talking about the starter car for the first time, the Art and Soul of Dune Volume 1. In Volume 2, Tanya Lapointe. Fantastic books.
Say that name one more time. Who is it by?
The Art and Soul of Dune, Volume 1 and Volume 2 by Tanya Lapointe.
Gotcha.
They are fantastic because they give you just so much insight into like the design and the creation of a bunch of different things for the movie specifically, and how the book was influenced by the movie, and even how stuff from like Lynch film influenced the modern film and everything like that. But they specifically call out the ship in one section of it, talking about how it was originally set to look like a giant wasp, but Denis Villeneuve and Patrice Vermette, who was the lead production designer for the movie, felt it was a little too obvious in terms of like what that ship was actually capable of if it had that wasp design. Ultimately, the art team landed on a, quote, gangrenous tumor as their influence.
That fits in line, I guess.
And there was direction from Denis Villeneuve to make the ship as ugly, or make the ship, quote, ugly and have the capacity to destroy and kill everything in its path. So it's not a good looking ship, as we see, even though it's like dark. And then we just see just the massive, you know, artillery barrage. And one thing that's very clearly noted as well is that, you know, the Fremen and to a lesser extent the Atreides, but definitely the Fremen are much more surgical in how they engage in combat, whereas the Harkonnen, like Beast Rabin, wield just a giant sledgehammer and just fucking will nuke an entire city just to get, you know, one person killed or whatever.
So this is drawing my mind back to a particular passage of the book. Later on, we kind of get some chapters from the Baron's perspective. After, you know, they've obviously they're coming to Arrakis. So once he's there, we do get some just thoughts from him. There's a scene in particular where he's watching a barrage like this happen, like kind of off in the distance. The Atreides have kind of fled the capital. They're hiding out in the hills and the caves around the shield wall. And I guess one of these ships is unleashing this like missile
just raining hell on everything.
Around and he makes a point to go. He's like, whoever would have thought about bringing back artillery barrages in a what do you say, in a time of shields? Like, it's just crazy to think that. He's like, that's why we're the best. And it, I don't know. It's interesting. So this does have some kind of ties back to the book. This ship, it's at least described in some kind of tangential way, which is cool. I like that.
It definitely shows like the my notes. I just have a line that says clearly it just shows the ruthlessness of the Harkonnen.
And I think that's about where our minute ends.
Our minute ends with that artillery barrage, and then it cuts right to a new scene right as we roll into the next minute. So I think we're gonna cut this episode there, and then, like the movie, roll into that new scene on tomorrow's episode.
So a couple things, and this is gonna be a theme of mine throughout this week, is a lot of the stuff does happen in the books, but it's mix-mashed together, and I couldn't exactly figure out where the best points to put some book comparisons and like and kind of anchor us in the novel according to the movie scene. So some of this might feel a little bit out of order, so I did my best to put them where it's not gonna like spoil things. Or
you mean the most chaotic portion of the book so far, at least, and the most chaotic portion of this movie is
chaotic.
Little disorganized.
Just a little bit.
Wow, who'd have thought.
So the first part that I wanted to talk about is actually a scene that's missing from the movie. So here in this scene, we see Jessica waking up on the ornithopter. Well, she's already awake, I guess.
Yeah, she's already awake. She's already, and we talked about how she's thinking to herself, like, why are they discussing this? It's futile.
Yeah, well, so that in the books, she wakes up, and maybe they filmed this because, again, she's already awake on the ornithopter. Maybe they did film this or had intention on filming this, but she wakes up about 10, 15, 20 minutes before this in a cellar. And we get to hear read a scene between Jessica, Piter, and the Baron, which is, three heavy hitters in this whole story.
It's also a little important knowing Jessica's relationship to Vladimir.
Yeah, but we haven't gotten into that.
Sure. But like, it's one of those things that when you, but it's one of those things that when you go back, it's like, oh shit, no, this is actually like super important.
Yeah. Yeah. So Jessica, wakes up with the Baron and Piter in this like cellar. And we get to know that she was promised to Piter. The Baron said, you know, after this siege and we take them prisoner, he can have Jessica. Because that's what Piter wants. He wants, you know, status symbols and power and stuff like that. But before that happens, he gives him a choice. He says, okay, you can have Jessica. She's bound. She's, you know, she's our captive right now. You can have her if you want. Or you can have Arrakis and rule in my stead, kind of thing. So
goddamn.
Yeah. So he gives her, he gives Piter this choice. And you know, before he says that, he tells Jessica, he goes, you know, just look how much, you know, you're desired over the planet. And he's like, just watch what happens here. So he gives Piter this choice and Piter almost immediately goes, I'll take Arrakis. And, yeah, just like, he's like, screw Jessica. I don't want her anymore. I want the actual power.
If someone offered you control over not only just, you know, the most desired planet, but also all of the income that would be
Well, yeah. And it's kind of there's two reasons for that. He wanted to, you know, literally kick, you know, or not literally, but, you know, kick Jessica when she's down.
Yeah.
Saying, hey, you know, you're not as desirable as this other thing, I guess. But he also wanted to see kind of into the mind of Piter a little bit. Like, how power hungry are you?
Yeah.
Are you willing for me to kind of go back on a promise that I've made you in for this other like shiny thing that I'm going to dangle in front of you?
Much shinier
thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting scene. We get to know, you know, kind of learn a lot about Piter. From after this conversation happens, that's when he brings in the Death Guard and the other guards that we see on the Ornithopter. They take him from this room, and outside the room is where Paul is still like knocked out.
Yeah.
And then they load them onto the Ornithopter and we pick back up where we see in the movie. So I don't know, just an interesting scene. I would have liked to have seen it in the movie. I think that would have been a cool, like, a cool bit of exposition. But it does kind of make the Baron's entrance a little less cool.
So,
which is what we'll get into later.
Well, hold on. As both of us know, there was a lot more filmed than what actually made the cut, right?
Yeah.
So, in addition to The Art and Soul of Dune, Volume 1 and 2, there's another book. Unfortunately, there's only one for Dune Part 1, but it's Dune Part 1, The Photography by Chiabella James. There's a either like one or two page spread, I don't remember, of photos of Jessica awake but bound on the floor, mm-hmm, of, you know, one of the rooms in the palace. And in the footnotes for that page, it talks about a abduction scene that was then later removed from the movie. Dang. So we had it. It was there. But like a lot of other
director's cut.
I know. And and I will like hope and pray for, you know, a extended edition Dune, because there's that scene. And then in that book, there's also stills from a scene where we see what's happening with Thufir Hawat during this whole, you mm-hmm know, sequence and everything as well. So there's so much more that we never got. And I understand they had to cut, but man,
yeah,
like that'd have been nice. You get these books and you look at all the like background stuff that was happening and the behind the scenes stuff. And it's like, mm-hmm, there's so much that we missed out on, and it would have been so fucking cool to see it. But either way, to your point about, you know, that book scene with it being as important as it was, the writers and Denis very clearly thought it was important, but unfortunately it just didn't make the final cut of the movie.
Cut for time. We understand.
Damn.
The last like a book note that I have here is while the Baron and Piter are having this conversation about, does he want Jessica or does he want Arrakis? Jessica's thinking to herself, like, what the hell am I doing here? Like, I, you know, she's confused. Obviously, she just woke up and bound and gagged in the cellar. She surmises a couple of things, that she was drugged.
Yep.
And that it was the drugs, you know, the drugs had to be timed specifically, according to her, like, weight and metabolism and all that kind of stuff. And there's only one person who would know this, and that's Yue.
Has to be Yue.
Yeah. So in the span of like just a couple of minutes, she deduces that Yue is the person who set them up and was, you know, the traitor, because up until that point, she didn't know.
Yep.
She had suspicions for a couple different people, Thufir Hawat being one of them. But yeah, it's very evident to her.
Not my boy, Thufir.
Well, you know, up until this point, you know, had suspicions, but this makes it, you know, evident and very clear to her that Yue is the traitor.
Yep.
So that's another important, like, kind of revelation that we get out of that scene, which would have been cool to see.
Who knows? Maybe it was shot.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Okay, cool. Yeah, man. That's all I had on this one. A lot of important stuff in this minute. So we're going to continue this this collection of minutes throughout the week that have just a bunch of important world building transitional stuff. So yeah, stick around. This is going to be a fun week.
Yeah, definitely. As always, you can find us online on Twitter. We are at Dune Minute. On Instagram, we are at The Dune Minute, and you can email duneminute@gmail.com if you'd like to get in touch with us. Otherwise, we will see you for another episode tomorrow, and we'll catch you later.
See ya.